This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
Good morning, and this is Brooke Spector with the Deep Dive, and we're delighted to be with you again, as we are every Friday morning at 9 o'clock. There are a couple of people that we turn to in this program to get further explanations and thoughts and insights into the way the world is put together. We have a favorite person we like to go to for understanding the parliamentary processes in South Africa, because they bear rather directly on all of our collective fates in South Africa. But when we talk about the United States, we like to turn to an old friend who is the Washington correspondent for the Guardian newspaper, David Smith. And David, of course, spent many years as the Africa correspondent for the Guardian as well in Johannesburg. And we got to know him then, and he moved on to Washington with his family, where he's been in the U.S. now for, I guess, about half a decade. And he has the kinds of insights as a foreigner who understands America that I think are helpful to foreigners who are trying to understand America. And if what is going on now in Washington had been put in a novel or a film script proposal, would anybody have published it, or would the producers of such a film say, this is madness and we're simply not going to proceed with the product? It's entirely too bizarre. It almost sounds like a parody of somebody's bad dream. But, well, here we are, and David is here to help us understand what it all means. Good morning, David. Thanks for joining.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
As many people around the world know, because we all pay attention to the news, Donald Trump, former president, survivor of two impeachment efforts, and now the subject of three criminal indictments and perhaps more to follow. How is that going to mesh with the upcoming primary and caucus schedule that the Republican candidates for the nomination for the presidency must go through, the 3,000 meter high hurdles kind of run that they endure these days? Donald has layered on to that a whole other things brought on by his own actions.
Yeah.
How is this all going to work?
It could be a car crash. I mean, we're really entering uncharted territory here. A candidate who's also facing trial on various criminal counts. And people do wonder about scenarios of, it's Tuesday, must be a campaign rally. Wednesday, I'm back in court. Thursday, back on a campaign trail, you know, bouncing back and forth between legal matters and the political calendar. It's an extraordinary collision, and everyone's holding their breath to see how it plays out. And of course, Trump is a bit of a master at trying to turn these situations to his advantage. He sees the political capital in all these court appearances and criminal indictments in terms of rallying his base of supporters. Many of them, you know, really buy his rhetoric about this being a political persecution, a deep state conspiracy involving Joe Biden and the Democrats. And he says, they're out to get me, which means they're out to get you. And so when he is on the campaign trail, he, refers to these criminal cases. Again, in a normal universe, 5 or 10 years ago, you'd have thought it would be an embarrassment, the last thing a candidate would talk about, and it would be career ending. But Trump instead charges right towards it, and knows that these indictments give him a boost. And, he said recently, all I need is one more indictment and I've won the election. And he may not entirely be wrong. Although, of course, the Republican primary is one thing, and he's still way ahead there, and his rivals are loath even to criticize him over these indictments. But the presidential election in November next year will be a different story. And one has to believe all this legal baggage will be something of a burden when he's up against Joe Biden.
You're a literary kind of guy in many ways. You're well-read and you've seen the world. Donald Trump is not exactly unique. There is a literary predecessor to all of this in a way, I guess. Willie Stark in All the King's Men who rose up from obscurity. Oh, that part doesn't quite mesh, but he made his political career successful by running against the elites, by running against those people, by running on behalf of you people, you the people that they don't like, that they look down on, that they snub. The irony, of course, is that Donald Trump started his life already as a millionaire and following in the footsteps of a father who had already made his money. And he sort of launched into his political career on the back of that, even though he was also trying to build support with the very people that under other circumstances he would have snubbed. What is his base? What is his support? Where does it come from? I mean, how does he manage to whistle this up magically?
I think that's the billion-dollar question. It's probably the one that fascinates me the most. And if I ever write a book about all of this, it should probably be on that subject, the psychology and the sociology of the Trump phenomenon. What is it that makes people drive hundreds or thousands of miles across America, line up, you know, sometimes 1 or 2 days in advance, they'll sort of camp out, sleep there, ready to attend a Trump rally, stand there through heat, through rain, eager to see this man in a kind of cult of personality. And at The Guardian, a couple of weeks ago, you know, we had a guest, a senior Republican official or former Republican official who, you know, very anti-Trump. And he was wondering, you know, what is it that makes all these people identify with Trump more than any other candidate? You know, they look at him and say, that's me, or, you know, and that's an alarming statement when you consider who Trump is. I think, you know, as ever with these things, class, gender and race are all factors here. The male, the macho masculinity sort of appeals to certain male voters, white and black and others. Class wise, you know, he grew up in Queens where, from what I gather and people I interview, and so it's written, you know, if you were in Queens, you kind of looked at Manhattan as the promised land. It was so near and yet so far. And Trump supposedly had a chip on his shoulder about not being part of the Manhattan elite within New York, and eventually sort of busted his way into that. And perhaps some of that translates now to this sense that he's still an outsider, and he channels the outsider spirit for many of his supporters who are also usually away from the big metropolitan areas. You know, they're not in New York and LA and Chicago. They're often in small towns about an hour or two away. And so that sense of being left behind and wanting to get revenge on the elites. And then perhaps most important of all is race. I think white America had the shock of its life when Barack Obama, the first black president, was elected. The statistics also show it shifted from a majority white Christian country to minority white Christian country. I think there's a lot of white grievance out there about changing dynamics, demographics, power slipping away in some ways. And Trump really gave them a license to feel that was legitimate and to vote accordingly. You know, his rallies are usually overwhelmingly white. He's got a record of saying some racist things, being supported by racist group and so on. And, you know, he really is channeling a racial backlash, in America, I think. And, all of these things sort of, at least partly explain his, appeal, along with, you know, the wealth, the kitschy nature of it, the gold leaf, the marble. People have said it's, you know, a poor man's idea of what it is to be rich, or, you know, the American dream. And you're right. I think, with your, you know, All the King's Men reference, and I watched that movie a year or two ago. Another movie from a similar-ish era, I think, would be a Face in the Crowd. Again, about a guy. I think he starts in prison, but he really is a marvel at being a populist and working the crowds, and you know, gets a radio show and thinking about going into politics. And the first time I saw that, it was actually in a cinema, an art house cinema, and at the end, when this character has finally had his comeuppance and he's shouting at sort of girlfriend or wife or whatever, you know, come back. You know, someone in the audience said, come back, Melania, you know, and he was kind of, his audience member was equating this person with Trump and could see the analogy. So yeah, there's that. And then I think, you know, within Shakespeare, people often sort of look to Richard III, perhaps, you know, sort of conniving his way to the top. Although just last week when Trump was in court in Washington, I quoted Richard II because fairly pathetic figure who'd lost his crown, you know, who'd lost power, but was still weighed down by all his cares and griefs.
Yeah, either that or Lear slowly going mad and losing his marble. We're going to take a station break quickly. We're speaking with David Smith of the Washington correspondent for the Guardian newspapers, and we'll be right back.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And we're back with the Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, and our guest today is David Smith, the Washington correspondent for the Guardian newspapers, now a long-term resident in Washington, but formerly the Africa correspondent, where we met him when he was based in Johannesburg. And we're chatting about the nature of Donald Trump's mystic power over people and his ability to sort of channel grievance. But you also mentioned something else, which just, it just triggered in my mind the following. You said that people tend to drive, many people, some people tend to drive hundreds of miles to go attend one of his rallies, almost as if they are cult, religious experiences. But I also thought of people traveling for days to show up at yet another Grateful Dead concert, going from city to city, town to town, to be with their emotional, their spiritual, their musical heroes. Presumably they have the time and the wherewithal to do it, because you don't, this is not a function of people with no jobs and with no circumstances. These are people who have jobs, obviously, and they have enough money to carry this off. So this isn't a revolt of the masses of poverty-stricken people. This isn't the sans-culottes rising up to seize the Bastille. This is something different.
Yeah, those are all great points. And I think a couple of things about Trump's support. Let's not forget, first of all, there are still the super rich, the wealthy Republicans. And there's a book called Wildland by Evan Osnos, which talks about, you know, in very rich parts of, you know, Connecticut, for example, hedge fund managers, super rich people, always traditional Republicans. Maybe they despise Trump's vulgarity, but ultimately they think to themselves, well, he's a Republican. He's going to cut taxes. He's better for me. I'm still going to go with him. You know, Trump still gets some of that residual wealthy Republican support, but more to the point, you know, I've been to many Trump rallies and I see the kind of people who go there. And it's absolutely true that they are not the poorest of the poor. I would say many of these classic Trump supporters, especially the ones we often tend to focus on in Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, these battleground states, shifted from Obama to Trump and in some cases shifted back to Joe Biden. You're talking really about lower middle class people, some maybe with manual jobs, so, you know, other kinds of work. You know, you might define them as blue collar, but, you know, they do have jobs. Now, within that, I think it's also fair to say they're often economically fragile. They're certainly fearful that their kids are going to be worse off than they are. In some cases, maybe they're working two or three jobs just to make ends meet. The price of, you know, gas or petrol goes up. They really feel it. And they're often in these depressed communities where maybe the local factory closed, there's deindustrialization. So, you know, they found a job, they found a way to make ends meet. But nevertheless, you know, you go to these towns, it's not exactly, you know, a booming, glamorous place. And you can understand where at least some of the grievance comes from. I think they have a search for meaning, a search for purpose. It's a time when communities have atomized somewhat. There's less church going. Maybe there's some sport. Local newspapers maybe have withered away. And along comes Trump. And suddenly, yeah, there is this solidarity they have. And, you know, I've heard people say things like, yeah, we can all be angry together, or we can all be sad together here. You know, it's and I would say a Trump rally is, you know, partly like a rock concert. There's loud music blaring. It's often baby boomer stuff, or, you know, it's a whole bunch of artists who hate Trump but can't stop him. You know, Elton John and Rolling Stones and so on. Just the nature of the crowd and the way people are hyped up. It's also got a flavor of a sporting event, especially something like a NASCAR rally in America, sort of red-blooded and macho. And the sporting analogy holds, I think, because, you know, a lot of the speeches, it's not only about what our team is good at, but it's also denouncing the opposing team. So political sense, that's the Democrats. So, you know, you cheer for Trump and you cheer for the Republicans when they say things, and then you boo Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the Democrats. There's that us and them sports style tribal mentality going on at these rallies. People also have fun. I mean, the rallies have become a traveling circus, a little cottage industry in themselves. And, you know, you talk about people who travel from rally to rally. I mean, that includes entrepreneurial people who set up all the merchandise stalls, and, you know, you see the same faces. This has become their life now. The sort of, you know, who knows when Trump disappears, what are they going to do? But they have become accustomed to coming to these rallies, setting up their stalls, selling, scarves and hats and pictures and other merchandise. It's all quite a show and a circus. And yes, you do see, the same, you know, some of the same people popping up. I think for this, collective sense, it's, you know, it's like church. It's like a sporting event. It's, you know, they feel they're with like-minded people and they belong.
It's sort of NASCAR meets Elmer Gantry meets the finals of the college football season, all sort of wrapped together.
Yep.
One thing troubles me, and perhaps you can help me understand this, this economic malaise that afflicts that, or at least the perceived economic malaise that afflicts that particular class or group or level of society. At the same time, this is operating in an economy with 3.5% unemployment. Inflation is now down to 3% in a bit. So the so-called misery index is below the critical threshold. 13.5 million jobs or so have come into being since Joe Biden became president, not directly from his hand, obviously, but as a function of the policies, it's created the possibility. And yet the polls all seem to say that people tend to think that the economy under Joe Biden and his administration has been doing poorly, and that his policies, whatever they are, because people seem to be a little bit fuzzy on what they are not working. That's something of a paradox, isn't it?
It certainly is. And if I knew the answer, I would be running a presidential campaign today. I mean, this is a big question that is baffling a lot of people in Washington right now. And I'm sure the White House would love the answer. I mean, exactly as you say, you know, Joe Biden can claim to have a very successful economic record coming in after the pandemic, turning things around. Unemployment is, you know, it's got its longest streak under 4% for half a century. And inflation was bad, but that has come down. And particularly when you compare the US to Britain and other major industrial nations, you know, it's had the best post-pandemic recovery. I think, you know, there are some caveats there in terms of how long does it take for people to actually feel it. Inflation still means prices are going up, even if the rate of inflation is slowing. And perhaps the big question there is, you know, have wages caught up, or at least sufficiently? And perhaps in some cases not, but there are signs maybe that should be happening too. More broadly, you know, some people speculate Democrats are not very good at telling the story. The message is not getting through. We're in such another point is, you know, in such a polarized political landscape now that no president on either side is going to get that much credit for a successful economy. You know, you've always got pretty tough ceiling. And there have been surveys that suggest, you know, the exact same economy. If Republicans are in charge, then of course Republican voters think it's all fantastic and the president's grateful. And then take the exact same economy, but the Democrats in charge, that those same people will say it's a disaster. It's all going horribly wrong. Meet the Press, Sunday politics show here the other day. They were speculating, you know, well, there's not an economic depression, but maybe there's just a political depression in America, and people feel so down and pessimistic about all the politicians that they'll blame them, you know, whatever the economic numbers are. But yeah, bottom line, it is a mystery, and it's one that I think is probably keeping people awake at night at the White House, because there's an election next year. And as we all know, the economy is often the number one factor, and people might believe what I would say is a complete myth that somehow Donald Trump and Republicans are better at handling the economy, for which there's very little evidence, but that's certainly not a perception Joe Biden wants to be out there.
We're going to take another quick break. We're speaking with David Smith, the Washington correspondent for The Guardian newspapers, and we're doing all things Donald Trump, and there are other politicians in America vying for the honor or the disgrace of becoming president. We'll get to that in a second. But this is Brooke Spector with The Deep Dive, and we'll be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is Brooke Spector. We're on The Deep Dive, and we are cruising along in a conversation with David Smith of The Guardian newspapers, their Washington correspondent. And we're trying to unwrap the mystery of American politics. We've decided that Donald Trump has sold a message that people believe, even if we can't quite figure out why they believe it. But if, as you say, there is this possibility that it's a political depression rather than an economic problem, what is the possibility emerging now of the so-called third party alternative in American politics? You hear mention of something called No Label, which is an odd kind of political formation which doesn't profess to propose anything other than, well, I'm not quite sure what. And then there's also Professor Cornel West, who is the flag bearer for the Green Party, and some Democrats still hold a certain grudge against the Green Party for helping them lose two elections in the past. What is the possibility now of this actually emerging as a real phenomena? Americans tend to think it's always been Democrats and Republicans, but conveniently forgetting that the first Republican president was actually Abraham Lincoln. Before that, there was no real effective national Republican party. So where do we stand now with this possibility emerging of an alternative version?
Yeah, it's certainly still a possibility, I think. And just to add to your examples, I was reminded recently that even in 2020, there was a third party candidate from the Libertarian Party who got a very small percentage of the vote, but actually did peel off some voters in the battleground states, possibly pushing Donald Trump's numbers down and allowing Joe Biden to win, you know, maybe made a difference in the electoral college. Yeah, No Labels is a group that is arguing, you know, Americans should have more choice beyond this duopoly, Democrats and Republicans, and that, and they're pointing to what we're talking about, political depression, you know, many surveys that show, people do not want Joe Biden as the nominee. They do not want Donald Trump as the nominee. But that's probably what they're going to get. You know, a replay of the 2020 election. And, tells us that the system is deeply flawed. You know, some would say American democracy is broken. Everything from the Electoral College to representation in the Senate, in all sorts of, ways, you know, gerrymandering in districts and so on. No Labels is coming along trying to shake things up. And my understanding is I think they've, successfully got on the ballot in at least some states, so far, but, not all of them yet. And it's been interesting to see quite a strong backlash against them. I've noticed particularly on the Democratic side, there's a group called Third Way who, you know, hold press calls, put out surveys, are very eager to tell you why No Labels is a disastrous idea. And the principal reason for that is the great fear that they're more likely to take votes away from Biden than they are from Trump. And certainly there are some commentators predicting you know, No Labels could really be the decisive factor in putting Donald Trump back in the White House. And, history is littered with these examples where certainly third-party candidates have been accused of tipping the election one way or the other. I think so, you know, Ralph Nader in 2000. And it's, it feels like a terrible, terrible, terrible situation, an unfortunate situation in that election after election now, with Trump as the Republican nominee, it's existential. And so Democrats have to be told, no, we can't experiment with a female nominee, and no, we can't experiment with a person of color, and we can't vote with an openly gay candidate such as Pete Buttigieg. And more generally, the message also goes out, no, we can't experiment with third parties because the stakes are just too high. Overwhelming priority has to be beating Donald Trump. And when you consider who Donald Trump is and what he did during his 4 years in office, you can see that's a not unreasonable argument. I don't know what's going to happen with no labels, but I think if there's any value to it, it's shining a light on the flaws in the American democratic system, some of which is antiquated, a lot of which really needs a shakeup, because we've seen elections where someone wins the popular vote but loses the electoral college and all sorts of other quirks and strange happenings.
I was asking you about the clearly geriatric nature of American politics. The two likely candidates for the presidency, one will be into his 80s and the other one will be nudging up against it. And two of the most senior senators in the Congress, Democrat and Republican, are both well over that age, let's put it that way, and have had public health issues that indicate a not total capability to do what they are elected to do. Is there something that Plato talked about, an ideal government with a philosopher king and a wise, sagacious council of elders? But I don't think he intended to have it take place in a frail care center, did he?
I doubt it. America has been described as a gerontocracy because you do have this generation of older leaders who are just sticking around and unwilling to move on. Although we did finally get, Nancy Pelosi stepping down as the Democratic leader in the House, replaced by the younger Hakeem Jeffries. But yes, Biden and Trump and Mitch McConnell and Dianne Feinstein and others. Someone the other day made a reasonable point that 80 years old for a senator is perhaps different from 80 years old for an office worker or, somebody doing a typical middle-class job, in that these people have some of the best healthcare in the world. They get a lot of attention and, they're pampered more than you and I would be. A debate certainly goes on regularly about Joe Biden's age. Every gaffe is seized on and scrutinized. And then, of course, his defenders remind us that, actually he's been making gaffes all his life. Who knows? And it's funny enough, I've sometimes seen this work to his advantage, I think, in that expectations are so low that he comes along and surprises you. I remember a few months ago, the White House Correspondents Association dinner, the usual conversations are going on about, oh, isn't he too old? And is he still fully with it? And actually, he came on, delivered a speech. It was punchy. It was witty. It was crisp. He did great. And,
you talked about his friend Jimmy Madison, if I recall.
Certainly Calvin Coolidge.
Older politicians, don't we say.
But there are problems with this. The average age of Congress is significantly older than the average age of the American population. And that clearly means some concerns and issues and ways of looking at the world are not being represented. And just to take two examples, young people are extremely engaged with the climate crisis. Some members of Congress, not so much. And even the Democrats, and especially Joe Biden, get a kicking sometimes from young climate activists over that. And then another example, infamously, would be the tech sector, social media and so on, where Mark Zuckerberg or some other leaders of tech companies will come to testify on Capitol Hill. And you can tell many members of Congress don't really understand the technology, don't get the terms, are somewhat behind the curve on that. So I think, wisdom is a great thing, and age can really vary from person to person. So it's hard to impose a hard and fast rule. You can have, a few weeks ago, I interviewed a woman who's 109 years old, and she was still pretty lucid and saying interesting things. Whereas, you can have someone in their 80s who's struggling a bit. So this is hard to legislate for, but at the same time, I think there is a sense of a desire to make space for a younger generation to come through.
Obviously, the electorate, the respective states, picked Mitch McConnell and Dianne Feinstein. and Senator Grassley as well, who I think is the oldest senator around. But they picked them, but they didn't actually have access to their full medical workup, and they didn't go through a cognitive evaluation test to prove that they were at the top of their game. I find it hard to, thinking in terms of your native land, the second time around for Winston Churchill, it was quite clear that he was no longer the man he had been a decade before, and yet he stayed in office for another, what, 4 years, 5 years?
Yes, and you reminded me just to think of other countries where, you know, maybe America is not such an outlier. I mean, if you think of, I think there's several examples in Africa of leaders in their 80s and 90s, and perhaps one would not want to hold up Robert Mugabe as a shining example of let's all be like him, but you get the point about globally there have been some older leaders, and of course she did not wield political power, but a lot of people thought the Queen of the United Kingdom, who died last year in her 90s, was great ceremonial head of state side of it, which of course American presidents have to do. So yeah, it's a tricky question. And you mentioned Chuck Grassley, as I recall. I believe he, you know, sort of gets up at 4 o'clock in the morning and does lots of press ups and or still goes jogging or something like that. So
maybe walking at this point. 91. I mean, you know, and let's be fair too. The leader of China and the leader of Russia, respectively, have both engineered their constitutional arrangements that they can basically rule until they're measured for, you know, for their final resting space. And the list does go on. One does want to recall also Ronald Reagan's debate performance, where he was taking on then Walter Mondale, former vice president, Reagan having some 20 years on him in age, finally turned to Walter Mondale and say, I'm not going to hold my opponent's relative youth and inexperience against him.
And yes, I've heard people say he won the debate in that moment. Flash of wit. Although again, the irony or paradox of that, I suppose, was that during his second term, and you'll know better than me, but I think it was often a whisper and a question, you know, is Reagan still there, and is it ultimately actually other people running the country because he's not entirely mentally competent, and so on and so on. And you know, worth remembering, of course, Reagan was younger than Joe Biden or Donald Trump.
That's true. We tend to think of Ronald Reagan as old, and in fact, he was even then younger than either of the two logical, at this point, contenders for the 2024 election. Before we go, just there's more than one person running for the nomination in the Republican Party. In fact, there's a whole dozen more of them. Where are they, and what are they up to? And I'll ask you to take a quick swipe at that after we go come back from our next ad break. This is Brooke Spector with The Deep Dive, and we're speaking with David Smith, the Guardian's Washington correspondent, and we'll be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is Brooke Spector in The Deep Dive, and we're speaking with David Smith of the Guardian newspapers, their Washington correspondent. And before the break, I asked him, there must be other people running for the Republican Party nomination, but we don't talk about them very much, it seems, all of a sudden. There's a whole dozen of them, and there'll be debates coming up soon. Where are these people, and what, you know, it's Donald Trump and 12 dwarfs or what?
Yeah, and I think that's the point. We don't talk about them because Donald Trump sucks up all the political oxygen, you know, not least through these appearances in court, which get wall-to-wall TV coverage, and it's like a sports commentary. The build-up, the match itself, the post-match analysis. Cameras are trained on his motorcade going to the court, and so on and so on. And it's difficult for other candidates to get a word in edgeways. And even when they do, many of them have been reluctant to say Donald Trump should go to prison. He's getting what he deserves. He's unfit for office. There are two or three who say that, like Asa Hutchinson, Chris Christie, and Will Hurd. And they have a combined opinion poll rating of about 10%, I think.
And all three of them seem, on the face of it, perfectly competent, reasonable people.
Indeed, yeah. Former governors, members of Congress, and so on, but just really out of step with where the Republican Party is right now, which is still, you know, the party of Trump. And there are surveys showing a majority of Republicans really do believe his big lie that he was the true winner of the 2020 election and Joe Biden stole it from him. And so all these candidates are struggling with that dynamic. I think many anti-Trump Republicans and donors and so on, you know, pinned their hopes on Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida. He seemed to be, you know, Trump without the baggage. You know, people say Trump with a brain. You know, he would bring you the culture wars and conservatism and the policies, but without all the Trump chaos. However, you know, he's really struggled to break through. Some of the warnings that he would not be good on the campaign trail seem to have been vindicated. Not a lot of charm and charisma. And interestingly, policy-wise, he's been running to the right of Donald Trump on some issues, such as abortion. And it turns out that has played badly. You can be more extreme than Trump, and it's probably not a good idea. And then there are others. Senator Tim Scott sometimes does well in polls. He's from South Carolina. Nikki Haley, the former governor of South Carolina, doing okay. Mike Pence, the former vice president, who's at the center of at least some of these legal investigations. He's just qualified for the Republican primary debate, which is in Milwaukee on August the 23rd. But that event will be like Hamlet without the prince, because we're not expecting Trump himself to attend that. Not much upside for him standing on a debate stage with his rivals. Rumors he may try and do some counter-programming and maybe, you know, an interview, a town hall of his own. But, you know, really right now, you know, there is still time for this to change potentially, but never in history has a candidate had such a lead like Trump and gone on to lose the nomination. So it certainly seems to be his for the taking, and the others appear to be auditioning to be his vice president. And
you say there's never been a lead like this, and the candidate with that lead not ultimately coming home first in the race. But if that leading candidate with that enormous lead should be shown up in one of his many court cases to be a liar, a thief, of something, does that change the dynamic, or does it simply, he just magisterially skates right past it? And as we talked earlier, that it just attracts more attention and more support and more interest and even some sympathy for him.
Yeah, he skates right past it. I remember, you know, Donald Trump's greatest, perhaps only, political pearl of wisdom was when he said, I could stand on Fifth Avenue in New York and shoot someone and not lose any voters. And actually what these court cases have implied is that perhaps he would even gain voters if he did that. Unhelpfully, I think many of these trials and court cases will not be televised. So there's a lot of Trump supporters out there who will just disbelieve what they read in the media about this or that happened in court, this charge happened or that. But, you know, he's already laid the trap. He's spent years, you know, building this argument that anything that negative happens to him is merely proof that the deep state is out to get him, that it's all political bias and a plot, and he is the martyr. So that's the paradox. The, you know, the worse it gets for him legally, the better it gets for him politically. And you know, that there are some who argue that, yeah, if he actually literally got sent to jail, and of course there are many barriers for that happening, you know, that would be the ultimate political shot in the arm of all. I mean, that would truly rally his supporters. And I should have mentioned earlier, I mean, in terms of, you know, who those supporters are and why they're so rabid and why they go for him rather than the other candidates. Interestingly, the most important dividing line in American politics today is not class or race or gender. It's education. And that that Trump base typically did not go to college or university, does not have a degree, whereas for them, the perceived elites are those people who did go to university and are democratic and living in major cities. And that dynamic is often in play in many of these arguments.
I can't let you go without reminding you, you said Donald Trump not appearing in the debates is sort of like Hamlet without the prince. But remember, too, there was a wonderful play which focused on that set of events without the prince. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead.
Yes, that's a good point. If I was going to be truly pedantic, I would remind you that, of course, Hamlet does have several cameos in that play. But
Fair enough.
I take your point. And that begs the question, who are the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of this Republican field?
That's the key. It's too early to tell. We're going to have you back again in a couple of months once some of this smoke has cleared so we can figure out what in the world is going on. Once the trial circumstances are clear, once some of the initial debates are done, and as the run up to the first primaries and caucus sessions in New Hampshire, Iowa, South Carolina, and Nevada, I believe, two primaries, two caucuses, and we can take a further look at that. We've been speaking with David Smith, Guardian correspondent in Washington, formerly Guardian correspondent in Africa. And as you can tell from our conversation, a man with a serious knowledge of theater and literature to boot. And we've had a good time. I'm glad we had a chance to catch up. And this is Brooke Spector and The Deep Dive. And we'll be back again next week with another discussion with someone who can shed some light on a public or a major issue in our world. Until next week, take care.